Welcome to the PDPW podcast, brought to you by Professional Dairy Producers, dairy's professional development organization.
Hello, it's always good talking with you. My name is Tom Thibodeau, a distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University, and today I'd like to talk about storytelling. The power of stories. Stories uncover the gold in our lives. How is it that you detect gold? Well, you take gold and you put it in the furnace and you scrape it and you test it, and there it is. What's really precious in our life has to be discovered and uncovered, and sometimes it's taken just being for ordinary dirt, but once you begin to explore, you begin to recognize there's something precious. It's the same thing in our own lives. Oftentimes we take for granted that which is ordinary in our lives, those things that seem mundane, and yet how important and significant they are. A teacher brought his students to a long-term care facility to learn the oral history of the community that the children grew up in. They were juniors in high school. And they brought out an older gentleman and an older woman in their wheelchairs who were into their 90s. And they started telling stories about growing up in that town and what it was like to live in that community back in the day. And after about 45 minutes, the gentleman said to the older woman, "I think we ought to stop. I think we're boring these kids." And the old woman sat up in her chair and she said, "Nonsense. Nonsense." And she pointed her finger at each one of those young people and she said, "If at the end of your life you don't have any good stories, what do you got?" And isn't it true? All of our lives are story rich. And sometimes we forget. We've given a lot of our storytelling over to technology or the media or to the television. We expect other people to tell us our stories. And yet each of our lives are so rich with stories of places we've gone and things we've done. People that we need to listen to because they have so much to offer us. There's a marvelous project that's taking place right now in trying to capture the stories of our final World War II veterans. Can we begin to understand what it was like as we begin to approach D-Day this week, that these were young soldiers, 16 to 18 years of age? At that time, we forget that schools would run 12 months out of the year so that people could graduate in 2 years rather than four, so that they could go off and fight in the war. 16, 17, 18-year-old students who finally found themselves on the beaches of Normandy, giving their lives for the prospect of freedom and defeating Hitler. How important and significant it is that we listen to the lives of those people who have sacrificed so much. Each of us has a story to tell. Each of us has stories that we've carried around for a long time, looking for and hoping that there be a story listener. Ed Hayes, who was a marvelous spiritual leader, was on pilgrimage, traveling all over the world, trying to find the truth of different traditions, a path forward in his life. And he found himself in Jerusalem, and he met the Coptic Christians, people from Ethiopia who did not have a church in Jerusalem, but would meet on the rooftops. And he was introduced to this community of Ethiopians, and each of them had a tattoo. The way they were able to distinguish themselves in that storied city filled with people from the Jewish faith and the Muslim tradition, where those Coptic Christians each had a tattoo that identified themselves so they could identify each other. And so he went to a tattoo shop that he was recommended, and as he walked in, the man who was sitting there in a tattoo shop said, "Are you a pilgrim or merely a tourist?" "I'm a pilgrim," he answered. I knew how easy it was to be saying that I was a tourist, to compromise the pilgrimage for the adventures of the trip. To seek the holy enshrines and holy places calls for a new style of traveling. A monk at a French monastery in Thésée asked me the same question, but in another way. I thought I made the decisions to separate the pilgrimage from the trip. And deciding where to go, what to see, and where to stay, I made the choices simple. I was seeking that which was sacred, but have come to realize now halfway around the world that it's dwelling everywhere. The man said, "Do you want a tattoo?" He smiled as he spoke. His lips parted slightly and his eyes danced. His question swirled around in the tiny room in a wild, taunting dance. That question surfaced memories of my childhood, the fear of the unknown, of pain, of the chill of waters in the swimming pool, the fear of being caught or having to be a real man. They all joined hands in the ring dance with his question and circled me in a blinding whirl. "I have many designs, ancient, sacred, and magical," he continued, without the trace of a smile. "The tattoo, you know, is more than a decoration. It holds the power to heal, to protect, to drive away evil spirits. It's your passport, if you're a pilgrim or are you not." "Does it hurt?" I asked, surprising myself at the honesty of the question that seemed to come from somewhere deep in the bottom of my being. His right hand slowly reached out and he placed it on my shoulder. The touch of his large hand calmed my heart, which was racing wildly out of control, sounding for a retreat, escape to the narrow street that led to safety. His hand on my shoulder was an anchor holding me back from setting sail as he spoke. "No, you will feel nothing. For 3 generations, my family has been tattooing our people who come to Jerusalem on pilgrimage. Not only are the designs ancient, and so are the methods. I will tattoo you as my father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather tattooed without pain." But I asked, "How is it that I will feel no pain? Do I take some drug?" "Oh, no drug is used," he replied. "The method is most ancient. I will tell you a story, and it will so absorb you there will be no left in you for pain. My stories will shield you from all that hurts and will heal you of all that lies within. I promise you, I know." And for the first time, I noticed them on his hands and arms were tattoos, and I could imagine that elsewhere in his body it was transcribed with those mystical markings. "Thank you," I replied. "I'm sure you're correct, but I'm not sure I mean about getting a tattoo. I'm an American, and my home country tattoos are usually worn by sailors and soldiers." "There'll be no pain," he said, lifting from his hand from my shoulder, pointing to one of the chairs by the table here. "Be seated. Be my guest, please. Allow me to show you the magic power. Please take a seat and simply close your eyes. Listen. Each story is not long, but you will see how it can fill every corner of your consciousness." How important it is that we listen to stories that are healing. So all those veterans so many years ago, now in their 90s, reminded when they were 16 with their friends on a beach in Normandy, fighting to protect freedom of the Western world. How important that they've carried around that pain for so many years, and the telling of the stories brings about healing. The same thing can be said for Iraq troops, our Afghani troops. The same thing can be said for firefighters and police officers. Can be said for EMT farmers in rural communities who, when they're called out at night, have to care for their wounded and troubled neighbors. How important it is that we offer places where people can tell stories. That used to be the place of a beauty shop or a barber shop. It used to be a place where people gathered at the Elks Club, the VFW, church basements, local taverns. Where do we tell our stories today? How important and significant they are. In a book called Have a Little Faith, Mitch Albom, who is the author of this story, Tuesdays with Maury, just a recap of that story, Mitch Albom went to college and his favorite teacher was Maury Schwartz. And one night as a traveling sports reporter, he was watching the evening news and there was Maury on TV talking about how he had been diagnosed with ALS, talking about all of his years of teaching and what he would miss by not being in the classroom. So Mitch made it his point to contact Maury Schwartz and would fly out to Philadelphia on every Tuesday and began to call it Tuesdays with Maury. And he would sit at Maury's bed and they would talk endlessly about their past, the characters that Maury had tried to teach his students while teaching them about lives and how Mitch became a great story listener. It was no longer about telling the stories of a Super Bowl champions or what was going to take place in the World Series or at Wimbledon, where Mitch had covered all those sporting events. Now he's listening to his old teacher and mentor talk about life and about death. And on his last trip out, Maury is in bed and he cannot move. And he says to Mitch, when you're in bed, you're dead. And Mitch says to Maury, you know, Maury, I've always loved you. And Maury smiled and said, I know. And with a gentle hand, he touched Mitch's hand. And in that moment, here was a conversation non-verbally between teacher and student. Maury died. Mitch wrote the book. Tuesdays with Maury later appeared on a television play and then was on TV. Then, because of his notoriety as an author, he goes back to visit his parents and goes back to his childhood synagogue. And the rabbi there, Albert Lewis, says, Mitch, I read your story, Tuesdays with Maury. I'd like you to preach at my funeral. And Mitch said, well, Rabbi, he said, I don't even know you. He said, well, then get to know me. He said, but I haven't been to the synagogue. Well, you don't have to just meet me in a synagogue. He said, come to my house and we'll talk. And again, like he had traveled to Philadelphia, and now he's traveling back to New Jersey to meet his rabbi and get to know him, Albert Lewis. And in writing the book, it's rather extraordinary. He was wondering, how is it that one becomes a rabbi? And he writes, which is why, given his profession, I wondered if he'd been divinely inspired. I remember Moses and the burning bush, Elijah and the still small voice, Balaam and the donkey and the whirlwind. To preach holy words, I assume one must have some kind of revelation. It doesn't have to work that way, the Reb said. So what drew you in? I wanted to be a teacher. A religious teacher? No, a history teacher. Like in a normal school? Like in a normal school. But you went to seminary. I tried. You tried? The first time I failed. You're kidding me. No, the head of the seminary, Louis Finkelstein, pulled me aside and said, Al, while you know much, we do not feel that you have what it takes to be a good and inspiring rabbi. What did you do? Well, what could I do? I left. Now this stunned me. There were many things you could have said about Albert Lewis, but not having what it took to inspire and lead a congregation? Unthinkable. Maybe he was too gentle for the seminary leaders or too shy, whatever the reason, the failure crushed him. He took a summer job as a camp counselor in Port Gervais, New York. One of the campers was particularly difficult. The other kids collected in one place, this kid went someplace else. If asked to sit, he would defiantly stand. The kid's name was Phineas, and Al spent most of the summer encouraging him, listening to his problems, smiling patiently. Al understood adolescent angst. He'd been a pudgy teen in a cloistered religious environment. He had few friends. He knew he never really dated. So Phineas found a kindred soul in his counselor, and by the end of camp, the kid had changed. A few weeks later, Al got a call from Phineas's father, inviting him to dinner. It turned out that the man was Max Cuttlesheen, a great Jewish scholar and a major force in the conservative movement. And at table that night, he asked, Al, I can't thank you enough. You sent back a different kid. You sent me a young man. Al smiled. You have a way with people, particularly children. Al said, thank you. Have you ever thought about trying for the seminary? Al almost spit out his food. I did try, he said. I didn't make it. Al thought for a moment, well, try again. And with Cuttlesheen's help, Al Lewis' second try went better than the first. He excelled. He was ordained. Not long after that, he took a bus to New Jersey to interview for his first and only pulpit position, the one he still held more than 50 years later. No angel, I asked. No burning bush. A bus, the Reb said, grinning. I scribbled a note. The most inspirational man I knew only reached his potential by helping a child reach his. In all of our stories, there's a moral, there's a lesson, way which teaches us how to live. In fact, stories reveal who and whose we are each and every day. A wonderful woman at our school, Sandra Bartlett, writes the story of her brother Joel. This is her opening statement of Brother Joel. He's the joy in my heart and the pain in my ass. That's how I often describe my brother Joel, born with Down syndrome. He is full of love and sweetness for sure, but it's his lifelong unintentional humor, mixed up sentences, funny conversations, innocent adventures, goofy faces, spot on imitations when describing what people look or sound like, and his unending rascally antics that led me to write this book. A family friend described Joe as special because he's Joe, a young man completely guileless when dealing with others. He possesses a freedom to be himself and sometimes to ignore convention and act on impulse. Haven't many of us wished to act on a whim or disregard being tactful at time? Yes, we have, but Joe seems to have taken it to a new level. Joe was the 10th child born into the family. He had 8 older sisters and 1 older brother. Joel had Down syndrome, and when he was brought home from the hospital, his mother told them, "You are never to call anyone a name. You are never to judge another person. Each person has dignity and worth. Joel is special, and we will take care of him." There was no room for words like institution or foster care. We are a large family, and Joe is one of us. And so, as Sandra was growing older, she became very fond of Joe, and she took care of Joe. And then Joe, after his parents died, comes to live with Sandra. Her mother was so worried, "What's going to happen to Joe when we're no longer here?" And Sandra said, "He's my brother, and I will love him for a lifetime." Joel, she brought him to our class and he spoke to us, and he was just absolutely delightful. This human being talking about pushing carts at the grocery store, it was his job. And he realized that not everybody was willing to return their cart to its place. Joel, who had memorized every song from Barry Manilow and broke out into song into our college class, Joel, who was just so excited to be the center of attention in a college classroom, and at the end said, "You're my friend," and without another word came up and gave me a big hug. Well, Sandra writes about Joel, about his mixed up words and sentences, and the absolute delight that Joel brings to the world every day. She writes, "Joe and I were shoveling mulch for the gardens, and Joe said, 'Oh, my leg hurts. I need some Pepto-Bismol.' I didn't have the heart to tell him that Pepto-Bismol has nothing to do with your sore legs. Joe had just finished cleaning his glasses, and on the way to bed, he said to me as he pointed to his eyeglasses, 'Well, spick and span.' He meant the household cleaning product Spick and Span, whose television commercials ended with, 'It's not clean until it's spick and span.' I asked Joe, 'What time is it? Can you look at the clock and tell me?' With a deep sigh, he reported the time. 'It's 9:15. It was actually 9:30 p.m. Joe asked me, "Want to yell at you at the top of my ears?" To his niece, he said, "You are a stubborn mule. That means you are like a fat buffalo." A neighbor had set off a firecracker outside, and Joe asked, "What was that gunshot all about? It scared the wits out of my pants." We were packing to move to a new house, and Joe was helping. His knees cracked as he sat on the dining room floor to help with the box. He said, "Ah, I cracked my knee knuckles. That kind of hurts." Goofing around and poking each other, I poked Joe on his chest, and he said, "Don't poke me in my heartbeat." Delightful. Stories capture the essence, the spirit of Joel. Stories capture the essence and spirit of all that we know. How important it is that we remember our stories. To forget what has happened to us is to forget our humanity. That's why Abraham Heschel says human beings are flesh and blood, memory and hope. I have a friend of mine whose wife has suffered for many years from Alzheimer's. He's in a small discussion group that we've begun, and he's just so thoughtful and compassionate and talks openly about how difficult his wife's disease was, early onset Alzheimer's. This is not the way that they anticipated or envisioned their retired life. For 4 years, they lived in the same house, and he was able to care for her. But the house had stairs, and he knew that it was important for his safety and for hers that they moved to a one-bedroom place. And so they found an assisted living place, and he took care of his wife for the next 8 years. He'd have to have somebody come in once or twice a week so he could go and get coffee with friends, so he could have just a little bit of a social life. He had to call people to come over and to spend time with his wife so he could go out and do grocery shopping or take care of errands and pay bills. He said it was difficult because no one ever just volunteered. He had to call and ask for help. How instructive that is. How many people do all of us know who could just use a bit of help but do not want to necessarily call? After many years, he said he was feeling a bit embittered. And then he starts thinking about it, and he said, 50 years ago, I made a promise. In sickness and health and good times and bad, to death do us part, I do. And then he reflected, how many times in a lifetime do you get a chance to make good on a promise you made at an early age? And from that moment on, caring for his wife was a sacred privilege, not an obligation. It was a way to fulfill a promise made of love, a love that is eternal. Stories. Stories tell us how to live. They reveal our character and the character of others. What are the stories in our communities that are untold? Some stories are very painful, and so therefore they go untold for a long time. Stories of war, stories of suicide, stories of depression or loss or financial ruin, stories of any kind of prejudice or hatred are oftentimes not spoken about because to talk about them would bring back painful memories, and yet we are only healed when our stories are told. That's why anonymous groups, people show up, and what do? They tell their stories about loss and triumph, about sorrow and joy, how important and significant it is. Well, one final story for all of you who've been so patiently listening. This is a story that comes from Tony Bennett, head coach of Virginia basketball team, who learned from his father, head coach of the University of Wisconsin-Madison team, and later from University of Washington, two very fine men, men of character, men of integrity, men who care deeply for the people that they coach, and always trying to find the words that would inspire or engage young men in so many practices, so many games. And Tony tells a story after one game in a surprising upset victory at North Carolina. A national correspondent asked one of his players, well, how were you able to upset North Carolina on their home court? And the young man said, just like coach taught us, you have to run towards the roar. Run towards the roar. Well, what does that mean? Well, Tony had heard the story from his father that an aging lion sits in the middle of the savannah. The aging lion can no longer run with the young lions, cannot chase gazelles or cannot even begin to navigate and defend oneself. So one sits in the middle of the lion's pride, and the young lions go and circle around the gazelles. And then the old lion does what only the old lion can do, and that is to roar. And the gazelles turn around, and they run right into the young lions who are waiting for them. Had they run towards the roar, they'd been safe. The moral of the story is that whatever we fear, we must run to it. We must embrace our fears. We must embrace our anxieties and then be willing to tell of our triumphs. I've survived. This is where I've been. Which brings us back to listening to the stories of veterans. I've survived. This is where I've been. These are the sacrifices that we're willing to make. We did not back off. We went towards the enemy, only to preserve the freedom of the Western world. Stories define who and whose we are. We all have them. So let's take some time this week to turn off the phones, set aside the TV, forget about the newest movie, and listen to the person right next to us. Ask them about the lives they lead, what's happened this day. Recognize that stories heal, much like the tattoo artist. Recognize that stories are filled with moments of joy, just like Joel. Understand that stories like Albert Lewis shows that even greatness begins in unintentional acts of goodness that might raise up the potential of another. Stories define who we are. Let's all have the courage to run towards the roar and then spend time listening to what it's taught us. Thanks so very much. Thank you. You're a great story listener, and it's always wonderful talking with you.
Our thanks to Tom Thibodeau for today's message. Tom, a distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University. And for archived podcasts and more on-demand programs, and for more on the professional development for today's dairy producer, head to PDPW's free website at pdpw.org. Until next time, have a safe and productive week.